Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to this very special edition of Atlanta Business Radio. It is time for Atlanta Cares, brought to you by the Atlanta Planning Group. Now here's your host, Grace Hayden.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here because we have, as usual, an amazing lineup, and we're going to start off by talking to Kay Eller. Kay Eller is the Executive Director of Vision Rehabilitation Services of Georgia, who rose up the ranks from her start as a volunteer in 2006. She's dedicated to improving the quality of life in our community. She's a wife, mother, grandmother, and also rides a motorcycle or two, and is a founding member of a local motorcycle riding club. Welcome, Kay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So can you tell us who founded VRS and why, and what's the mission?
So we were founded actually in Smyrna. So we're a local Cobb County 501c3 back in 1983. There was a lady by the name of Sarah Scott, and she had a degenerative eye disease that created issues to where she finally could not drive, but still had a home to take care of and a business to continue to run. So she went looking for services, and finding none, discovered that she had folks that would support her, friends that would throw money in, church support, etc. And so she found Vision Rehabilitation Services in her basement. 37 years later, we're not only serving Cobb County, but also 34 Northwest Georgia counties.
Wow. And so how many people are on your team?
Well, we work with a variety of folks that specialize in vision rehabilitation therapy, orientation, mobility, and some other specific things that you are trained for to teach those with visual impairment that can't be repaired how to do things differently. So we do have a number of contractors that are specialized in this industry. So on an average, we have about 11 different instructors. We have an administrative staff that consists of four of us consistently. And then we do depend upon not only our clients as volunteers, but the public also as volunteers. So that varies.
And so who's eligible for services at your clinic?
Basically, anyone who has an eye condition that cannot be corrected with glasses or surgeries or medications. And so the age group, to be honest, is anywhere from children all the way to, I think our oldest client right now is about 104. And so there's aging eyes. The way you become eligible, unfortunately, is loss of vision that really impedes your daily activities. So this could be individuals that are working, maybe have a slip and fall, car accident, various neurological issues that would take your brain or your vision away. Others might be like stroke victims. Some folks are just born with eye diseases that degenerate over time. And so our goal is to make sure that they know about us and to come to us so that we can do some job saves. That's one of our big efforts, is to go in and explain to employers how you can, while you've invested all this money in people, how can we keep them employed even though their vision's changing? Well, they'll just do their job a little differently, and we've got the tools for it.
So what are some of those things that employers can be doing to support an employee who may have had an event in life that's changed their vision abilities?
Well, one of the things would be to actually have us come in and do, and not just for employees who've had an accident or a vision change, but just general employees. We can come in and actually do an environmental scan and recommend changing the lighting, changing just the way an office is set up. If an individual has actually called us in because they are having vision problems and we need to help do a job save, it could be as simple as, instead of the window being to their back and putting a glare on their screen, let's turn it around. So it's really a variety. We also, depending upon how severe the eye condition is, there are tools. So if they did a lot of work on the computer, maybe it's more about teaching them technology that's available, such as screen readers and tools, magnification tools and things like that. So everybody's needs are going to be a little bit different. But the key is that employers, again, they invest so much in an employee. Who wants to lose them just because they need to do it differently?
So what are some things you can do on the front end to protect your eyes or get ahead of being proactive with your health when it comes to your eyes?
That's a great question. One of the very first things that I want to always share with people is please get your eyes checked every year. People only go because maybe their vision insurance only covers glasses every 2 years. That's so wrong. Get your eyes checked every year and do the dilation. There is so much that can be caught just from preventative maintenance on your eyes and early detection that they can start treating things that they see. The other would be please wear sunglasses. We have had stories of truck drivers that had been driving for years and the glass, no sunglasses, the sun hitting the glass, burning, I don't know if it really burnt their retinas. I'm not a doctor, but basically their eye condition was caused by driving so long and so many years with no sunglasses. And the last tidbit, we call it the 20/20/20 rule. We are a world right now of staring at screens, televisions, computers, smartphones, tablets. So every 20 minutes, take a 20-second break and look at something 20 feet away because your eye is a muscle. And we all go to the gym and things like that. So work your eye muscle too.
That's good advice. So is that when you go to the eye doctor, do they do a comprehensive low vision exam? I saw something about that on your website and I thought to myself, you know, I go to the eye doctor, but I don't know that I've ever done that.
Well, hopefully you will never need a comprehensive low vision eye exam. It's a special exam done by a specially trained optometrist who has a doctor who has concentrated on low vision. And we contract with specific doctors who specialize in low vision, and it's a totally different exam. Now, you'll come into our office, and we do have a clinic twice a month in our Smyrna office, and once every other month or more, we do a traveling clinic up in Rome. And the key is, when you sit in that chair, your exam is really more of a consultative discussion about what are you no longer doing because your eyes aren't what they used to be. And he's going to actually evaluate what tools and what mechanisms do you need? What training do you need? And one of the first things he's evaluating, of course, is safety. So he might recommend some specific training like orientation and mobility, which is a specialized certification for learning how to travel safely in all environments. And it also includes not just learning to use the white cane that everybody's kind of used to seeing with visually impaired or blind people, but also how to use different forms of transportation, how to use what's available in your community and how to get around. But he'll also observe and talk to you about tools and techniques and then just additional training from like a vision rehab therapist. And those are people who are going to come in and teach you how to do your closet in a different fashion or how to identify colors.
Wow, that is so interesting. And so if someone wants to apply for services or support, are they covered by insurance? How does that work?
Unfortunately, you know, you can have a heart attack and end up in cardio rehab or fall and break a hip and you end up in rehab. All of that's going to be covered by health insurance. But lose your vision, and unfortunately, it is not covered by insurance. So we have various programs that we contract with federal and state agencies. We also are in 11 different school districts, so we actually complement the teacher for the visually impaired. They're not always trained in all of the facets like orientation and mobility and things. So we'll come in and complement what they're doing to help the students get through. We also hold fundraisers. We have an annual spooktacular chase that's a Halloween-themed 5K, 10K. I'm proud to announce it's our 12th year.
Wow.
And that's a blast. And we have put teams together and things like that. In the past, we've also done things like dining in the dark. So the real key is to make sure that we have ongoing type funding for those who won't be able to afford it. Because as you can imagine, your life changes when your vision changes. There's a been many studies where they'll ask in group settings, if you absolutely had to lose one sense, what one would it be? Nobody ever picks vision. Never.
What do they pick?
Well, if you make them pick, it's going to be like smell and hear. Yeah. People will actually pick hearing over vision.
Interesting. And you also do some sports related events for the visually impaired, right? When we were in the lobby, you mentioned climbing and swimming and.
Yes. And this is going to be a little plug for a very special, entity. It's called Georgia Blind Sports, another, not-for-profit that we work closely with. Hal Simpson is the founder. And, basically it is an organization that any sport that anyone does can be done, even if you don't have any vision or very, very low vision. And so, you name it, they do it. They play darts. They bowl. There is a thing called goal ball. And it's actually hosted in Smyrna, the Nationals, in May. And that is, picture soccer, I guess is what I would, I'm not a sports person, so I'm going to say soccer because the ball is a soccer ball with a bell in it. And so everybody has to have equal vision. So everybody is blindfolded or darkened glasses. So they're all equally can't see anything. And the ball goes, they play on their knees, so knee pads and things, and the ball goes from one goal to the other. And it's all by hearing what that bell's doing. So something cool. Look it up, Georgia Blind Sports. Just Google it. And we'd love to have some volunteers out there in May, too.
And so you partner with local organizations and you mostly do fundraising, I guess. How do you raise funds and what kind of resources do you guys have to keep your funding sustainable?
Well, like I said, we do contract with federal and state organizations. So we also will partner with individuals who not only are we looking for funding, but we're looking for sponsors to help us with our career orientation, job readiness. Another facet of what we offer. And so we will partner with just local businesses. I happen to be a member of Smyrna Business Exchange, BNI, and there's 56 businesses in there that I can count on them to help me. If I call up and say I've got an individual who's considering a career in computers, we've got somebody who will let them shadow. So it's not always about cash. We do need cash because it's not covered by insurance. A lot of times they may not even qualify for one of our federal or state programs. And it's those folks that fall in that gap that, they're not 55 plus and they don't want to go back to work or can't go back to work. And so that's where I run into how do I find funding? So online, we do have a donation, link, obviously, as a 501c3, we better. You can sign up. Our logo, or our theme, I should say, is on the 20th of each month, how about donating $20 here in 2020? And that would actually, $100 will buy 2 hours of training for an individual to learn how to travel safely or learn how to use a computer differently.
Wow. Or the career training.
Absolutely.
What's involved in the career training?
Well, once someone has identified what their passion is and we really identify what their skill sets are, which they don't always match, just any normal person looking for a job, the key is we will actually go in and identify what the tasks are. So we're literally breaking the tasks down. Our instructors who specialize, again, in training the visually impaired and low vision, they are going to map out the entire day. So they will go through, how do you get from your desk to the restroom or to the kitchen? So it's the everyday things that we probably all take for granted because we use our eyes and we figure out how to get there. There's training in how do I get around that work environment. Then the tasks are broken down. So maybe it's your receptionist and you're going to have to do the mail. What does that entail? You know, do we need to identify a special magnifier because of your vision condition? In order to figure out whose mailbox you're going to put that mail in, you need a certain magnifier. Or if you're going to be doing data entry, we need a computer that they're going to allow us to install a specific program that you need, whether it's Zoom Text or JAWS or Fusion. Those are special programs that do screen reading. We've got an individual that actually she'll answer the phone and take information and put it into a Excel spreadsheet. So in one ear is the telephone and in the other ear is actually her computer talking to her because she can't see the screen, but it tells her how to navigate so that she can input the data.
That's incredible.
So the key, your long answer, but the key is we go in and figure out what their tasks are and what do we need to do a little bit different to solve that.
And so before this, you worked in finance. You had a 20-year career in finance, worked for some of the top companies, and then you changed paths. What made you choose to go into vision rehabilitation services?
Well, it was kind of an accident, but my entire career, and I love her. She gave me 20 years. You could probably add almost 10 to that. Mm-hmm. But I was in a variety of home offices, brokerage firms. I was also with a consulting firm. And the key there, I was always concentrating on the executive benefits. Not that executives don't earn and deserve what they get, but when I had the luxury of being able to kind of pick and choose what I wanted to do, I went more for direct sales. And what's the first thing you do when you're going into direct sales? Contact those you know. So I showed up at Vision Rehabilitation Services because I had been a volunteer there since 2006 and said, hey, can I pitch my supplemental insurance to you and your staff? And she said, sure. So we sat down and we did that. And then somehow I ended up being a coach for the Spooktacular Chase, a chair for the Spooktacular Chase, which again is our 5K, 10K in October. The following year after that, I was actually the co-chair person. And in the middle of doing all of that, they received a grant for a business development position. And the director at the time, the executive director at the time, approached me and said, would you consider? And I said, I've been around here since 2006. I might as well get a paycheck for it. So sure, I'll do it. So
sounds fair.
Sounded fair.
Yeah.
So I jumped in, and 2 years later, she decided to retire. I put my name in the hat. I was interim executive director from July when she retired at the end of June until November of last year. The search committee looked at a number of folks, and lo and behold, here I am.
Well, congratulations. And I can tell you're very passionate about the work that you do and proud of it. And you're doing good things for the community. So for some listeners who might want to get involved with Vision Rehabilitation Services of Georgia, what can they do to help you guys continue your good work? Do you have any events coming up or...
Right now, we are actually in the middle of some planning stages. A few of our funding sources have changed a little bit. We had a committee that chose not to do our May Dining in the Dark. So we actually are concentrating right now on really more online presence. So this is wonderful. I look forward to reposting this. And then obviously, we're gearing up for July 4th. We will be at Powder Springs. Springs Fest. We will have a booth out there. So we are looking to just really get the word out. So that the key is we are a very hidden secret in Smyrna. You don't know us until you need us. And then you got to hunt us down. So the key would be helping us get the word out about what we do, get the word out about donations, setting up an online kind of set it and forget it would be wonderful. And then volunteering at Spooktacular Chase or coming out and doing a 5K or 10K with us in Powder Springs.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming in today and sharing with us the good work that you're doing. And we've got two more awesome guests. I hope you'll stick around and listen.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you so much. Next up, we've got Ted Bradford, a community builder and urbanist at heart and through practice. He moved to Atlanta in 2005, got his master's in urban policy studies from Georgia State University. His experience in real estate brokerage and development, as well as his role as the former chief of staff to council member Natalyn Archibong, led to his wealth of knowledge on the ins and outs of city life and the political market and social forces that shape it. Now he's with Gene Kansas. So Ted, tell us your story. Why commercial real estate and why Atlanta?
Well, I moved to Atlanta right after college. I graduated from the University of Maryland. I was born and raised in Maryland in the DC area, which is where my love of cities came from because DC is a beautiful and spectacular city. But I moved to Atlanta with a friend of mine on a whim, basically. We were driving around D.C. looking for an apartment to rent after we graduated, and everything was really expensive. And he said, hey, I heard Atlanta is fun, great for young people, and cheap. So we bought a car for $500 cash from a coworker of mine and drove to Atlanta on Labor Day weekend of 2005. And it was actually the same weekend that Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
And we almost kept going thinking, well, we can get some sort of cleanup temporary work, you know, just because we're floating around out here. But we ended up going to Randstad, the temp agency company, mm-hmm. and just got jobs stuffing envelopes here in Atlanta. And I've been here since.
Wow. So where was that job stuffing envelopes?
It was for a small student organization that worked with university career centers around the country. Okay. And we helped in their mailroom.
Interesting. And so you chose commercial real estate because you grew up in DC and just you loved your city and cities.
Yeah, I would say that I didn't intentionally choose to get into commercial real estate. I didn't go to business school. I studied government and politics as an undergrad, and I came down here to Atlanta and was just working odd jobs, stuffing envelopes and things like that. And when I decided I was going to go to grad school, I looked at Georgia State University, and the Andrew Young School of Public Policy had a Master's of Science in Urban Policy Studies program. And I read through it. I thought it looked great. It didn't have a thesis requirement. It was all coursework. So I signed up and started taking classes. And that's when I really started learning about the history of Atlanta from a policy standpoint. There's a couple of like foundational texts that you end up reading in grad school that are based around Atlanta history and Atlanta politics. So I really grew to appreciate and love Atlanta from that standpoint as well. And then ending up in commercial real estate was just kind of a natural progression. One of the things that we had to do in grad school was go to our local neighborhood organization. And in Atlanta, we have neighborhood planning units. Mm-hmm. And I started attending those meetings. I went to one and I was like, this is great. I'm going to keep going even after the assignment was over. So I kept going and I figured if I'm going to be here, I may as well volunteer to do something. So I volunteered for committees. I ended up running the public safety committee in East Atlanta for a couple years. After a while, they asked me to be the vice president. So I was the vice president of my neighborhood organization. And then eventually I became the vice chair of my NPU.
What's an NPU?
The neighborhood planning units are collections of three or four neighborhoods that all come together to vote on certain policy matters in the city of Atlanta, usually public safety related stuff, permits for special events in public parks, that kind of thing, or land use and zoning matters. They get to make a recommendation on special administrative permits and variances and other zoning related matters. This was actually started by Maynard Jackson back in the 70s. Okay. He established 25 of these around the city, and everyone gets to come and vote on local matters that make recommendations to the Office of Planning and the City Council. So one of our assignments in grad school was to go participate in one of these meetings. I happened to enjoy it and kept going back. And then once I kind of got on a roll with that, there were other opportunities that opened up. There were always like boards and commissions and task forces that are established by the city of Atlanta to look at a specific policy issue or some, you know, development that's happening in a neighborhood. There was a downtown development technical advisory group looking at underground Atlanta many years ago before all the changes that have happened there recently. And I managed to get myself appointed to that committee as a citizen representative. And that got me in front of a lot of people running Invest Atlanta, Central Atlanta Progress, a couple of the Georgia World Congress Center, some of the larger stakeholders in downtown Atlanta. So just by being active as a citizen, I kept meeting and engaging with people that were in real estate or doing development in Atlanta. It was at that same time that I led a protest against a development in my neighborhood. And that's how I met my council member, because I was protesting. And
what were you protesting?
I don't know if I want to say exactly what it was, but it was a large development in my neighborhood that was controversial at the time.
Okay. We can leave it at that.
Yeah. And I rallied the troops online and sent like 600 emails to all the Atlanta City Council members. And Councilmember Archibong pulled me aside and asked me if I thought that was effective. She was like teaching me through a Socratic method. And I thought about it and I was like, you know, I probably just made a lot of noise and didn't really move the needle. So I stayed in touch with her and started refining my participation and trying to be more effective. And then after about a year or two of continuing and being a little bit more measured about it and responsible in my advocacy, she offered me a job to come work in her office when she had an opening. So I jumped at that chance, and that was how I became her chief of staff. In that time, while working for her, I was invited to be on a panel discussion about urbanism, and the moderator of that panel was Gene Kansas from Gene Kansas Commercial Real Estate, which is how I met him. So it was all these natural connections from just being involved in civic life in and around downtown Atlanta. A little bit later, he was doing a development in our district, in District 5, Councilmember Archibong's district, and he had an issue that he needed help with. So we just helped him as a constituent. So I met him again through that. We were able to help him with his problem, had to do with the water meter. It was a pretty easy fix. And then we just stayed in touch. And about a year or so later, he said, hey, would you want to come work with me on some of these projects? And I had never, until that point, never really considered going into business, being in commercial real estate from a business standpoint. I was always on the policy, government, political side of cities. But once you're in that world, it kind of became apparent to me that it didn't matter whether you were on the business side or the government side. It's this public-private partnership, this larger coalition of people, citizen actors, all working together. So to me now, it really seems like a natural progression and not like I made a big career shift, but really that I'm still participating in the same thing, just playing a different role in the process.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a goal of yours was to influence culture and the functionality of a city, preserve cultures in your neighborhood. You fought to stop a development. So how does Gene Kansas work as a cultural developer in addition to just commercial?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way to describe it is we don't look at real estate transactions as a commodity. We think of them as, you know, building blocks of the city environment that we're all engaged in. So when I think about people making culture in Atlanta, I kind of just think about it as people doing and creating things for themselves and others for its own sake and its own enjoyment. You know, not necessarily, I mean, this could be, like I have a friend who runs Atlanta Matchbook History, an Instagram account where he is now just looking at historic buildings in Atlanta and creating content and educating his other friends on Instagram about Atlanta history. That to me is creating Atlanta culture. And there are a lot of people that we get to work with that are building companies or doing something creative in Atlanta that are Atlanta based that, I mean, everyone needs space. Everyone needs an office. We help them make those decisions. These are usually pretty big decisions for people, whether they're moving an office or building a building or buying a property. So all these people that are building what it is to be in the modern Atlanta need help with this aspect of their business. And we help them with that. We also, we're doing a development right now in Virginia Highland that I think is going to be really incredible for the neighborhood. We're taking a 3,500 square foot little retail building that's at the corner of Virginia and Highland. It used to be the end of the streetcar line 100 years ago coming out of downtown Atlanta. And there's all these great little buildings with shops that have been there for 100 years. And we are helping a client of ours who's owned them for decades, and he's now reinvesting and bringing them back up to a brand new condition on the inside. It's actually a historic preservation project. So we're preserving the building, but fixing up all the systems and making them new to allow for the next 10, 20, 30 years of occupants to take over these spaces and create something new there. We're really excited that Paolo's Gelato, who's been there for 21 years, he's staying. And next to him is going to be a pizza place. That's Pizza by the Slice. It's Anthony from Old Fourth Ward Pizza and Nina and Raffi, who's known as, you know, making the best pizza in Atlanta right now. And now he's going to come and open just a neighborhood pizza place, pizza by the slice on the paper plate, the classic neighborhood pizza joint. And it's an incredible opportunity to get to create that for a neighborhood, to think that some kid who's growing up in Virginia Highland right now, when he thinks of that local pizza place in his neighborhood, you know, we helped put that there, which is an incredible feeling, and it's a lot of fun to get to participate in that for the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, you're participating in Atlanta history and landmarks that they'll talk about when they're old to their grandkids. Like, I went on a first date with your grandma to the gelato place.
Exactly. We got a slice of pizza and then went next door and got gelato, and now you're here.
Yeah, exactly. And so you mentioned you were attracted to Atlanta from a policy aspect. When I think of Atlanta policy, I think of MARTA not expanding. I think of traffic and how we need to address that. So educate me. What is it about Atlanta policy that for you was something that you thought, yes, that's, I'm interested in this. I want to study at Georgia State. I'm learning about this. I enjoy it. And I want to get involved in this.
Well, I think Atlanta has a history of pulling together as a community, business community, political community, the citizens all coming together and punching above their weight. You know, people talk about Atlanta's ability to attract the Olympics, a pretty big Olympics too, the Centennial Olympics. We've done big things here, and we've done it through cooperation and understanding. A lot of the books that we read in grad school were about the transition of the city of Atlanta through the civil rights movement. And that took a lot of cooperation by a lot of different people. And Atlanta navigated that tumultuous time in American history a lot better than other cities did. We've done a good job at coming together to tackle some of the important issues. There are always things that aren't going to work as well as others. You know, I understand people want MARTA to go everywhere and all that sort of stuff. But there's a lot of the nuts and bolts of maintaining a growing and thriving city that Atlanta has done really well. If you look at Atlanta 50 or 100 years ago, it was not one of the largest regions or biggest cities in the country. I think we're now one of the top 10 largest metro regions in the entire country. I mean, we've been an incredible success story. And I think there's something exciting about Atlanta.
I love that. And we've also seen, you know, some other examples of Atlanta. I like what you said, us punching above our weight. We recently developed the Beltline, and that's been huge for the city. Do you want to touch on the growth of that and some of the other things you've got going on? I know you mentioned Indie Studios and a couple other projects.
Sure. Yeah. So I think the Beltline is a great example of something exciting that Atlanta's doing, because we're now talking about retrofitting centuries old infrastructure to a modern life and creating a new city, a modern Atlanta around it. That is, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? I mean, it is incredibly popular and there is tons of growth around it. For better or worse, it is a success. And that success is continuing and will continue. And I am on the side that it's a good thing. I'm a proponent of the Beltline. And one of the exciting things is that it's going to continue north of Piedmont Park to a neat little area that we're doing a lot of work in, the Armour-Ottley Loop. I think people are primarily familiar with it because Sweetwater moved there many, many years ago.
Yeah, everyone in the room's like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so where Sweetwater Brewery is, there's a great little loop that used to be a railroad spur with a bunch of warehouses on it back in the 40s and the 50s. And it was a place of making and doing an industry in Atlanta based on this old piece of infrastructure. And like the idea of the Beltline in general, the same thing is happening in this neighborhood where this old rail corridor is now being converted to the modern Atlanta. So all of those old warehouse buildings are being adaptively reused, is what we call that, into incredible office spaces for engineering and design and tech companies and software developers. The folks we work with over at Cinemassive build these massive display walls, and they build the computers and write the software that power them. And these things are in like large weather centers and command centers across the globe. And it's incredible technology, and it's being built right here in Atlanta across the street from the Sweetwater Brewery. And they have assembled a little campus of buildings that we're helping them to redevelop and reposition. One of them is Indie Studios, which is a continuation of our shared space developments that we've been doing. We have one downtown on Auburn Avenue called Constellations that is focused on civic and socially based organizations. Since we are on Auburn Avenue and it is the epicenter of civil rights in Atlanta, and it has a history of that and a legacy of civic and socially based organizations, our development there was to create a shared space for civic and socially based organizations in Atlanta now. So it's the same model, but Indie Studios is going to be in a more tech engineering design area. So it's going to be shared space that reflects that community around it. So it's going to be about design and engineering and technology.
Very exciting. And so if somebody listening right now is about to move offices and wants your insight or maybe just your consultative advice on a project, how can they find out more about you and your business?
I would say the easiest thing is to go to our website. You can go to genekansas.com to learn about the brokerage business. And if you're interested in Indie Studios, the website is Indie Becomes You, I-N-D-I-E, IndieBecomesYou.com. And both have tons of information, good stories about some of the projects we've been involved in to help you get an understanding of the other kinds of projects we do. And there's a way to contact us as well.
Excellent. So we've got one more guest. Thank you for your interview.
Sure.
I hope you'll stick around and listen. Great. Next up, we've got Jameen from Skylar Security. It's an emerging as an innovative leader in the industry of privately owned security companies by offering the next generation of services to customers in Metro Atlanta and throughout the United States. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited you could make it. I know the traffic. We were just talking about it, but
it was painful when we got here.
Yeah.
Safely.
Great. So one of the things that I really liked reading your bio was that you're a female entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I too am a female entrepreneur. So I was kind of curious about your path to success. You also chose a really interesting industry to be in, security. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you did it?
So I know you guys can't see me, but I'm not a little girl, and I've used that to my advantage. So I was a successful athlete from as far as I can remember, as a young girl. And so when I was in high school, I tell this story, and it's a story I'm proud of. I was a bully's bully, you know, flat out. I would, advocate for those that needed the voice and advocacy, and I loved it. So they would always say, come on, just leave us alone, Motown. And I would say, no, how about you leave her alone? You know, just carry on, you know. And then I would sit with the person that I advocated for and just talk to them and get to know them. I've always had a heart for community, always had a heart for, protecting people. So I started, a small business when I was a police officer, and I, did executive protection. So I was a bodyguard. And I focused on female executives, and I loved it. I had so much pride in it. I didn't take it lightly. And so over the course of my life, I realized that not only am I very passionate about what I do, but that security is an emotion and it's not a business. And I noticed that when I was in, when I was working for Clayton County Police Department for 5 years, my colleagues, we had so much pride in being police officers. Like, you couldn't tell us anything. Like, that was, you know, short of, you know, standing next to Jesus, you know, it was something that we were all proud of.
And you were in Clayton County.
I was Clayton County Police Department. Right. I've been resigned, I left to go all in, and it was one of the best decisions I've made in my life. But while I was there, I learned community. I learned the rapport that you have and your willingness to put your life on the line for your colleague. And that's very serious. You know, I tell people, they're like, oh, you look good in your uniform. I said, this is nothing about looking good. Like, I really have a bulletproof vest on. I don't know if you can see, like, the uniform has a bulletproof vest on the inside. So every day there's a worry and a concern and an anxiety about going home. But, there was something very prideful about that job. I did my research in the industry, and I discovered that there are more unarmed guards protecting our communities than there are police officers. And so the question is that I asked the industry is, why do we allow security guards, unarmed, because that's the majority, off the hook on excellence and quality service? So I asked my colleagues, joked, and it was at roll call, and I didn't tell everybody what I did. I kind of kept it low because we were beta testing some of our systems, and I didn't want to do that in the public. I wanted to do that kind of on the back end. But word was getting out, what I was doing, and my colleague says, you have a security company? I said, yeah, I have a security company. I was trying to downplay it. Yeah, I have a security company. They were like, secure, and they just started on this banter. And I heard that.
What were they saying?
They were just like, oh, you got mall cops. Like, the, you know, what do they look like? You know, why are you in security? Like, it's guards, you know, because we are police officers. Mm-hmm. And guards, security guards are of a lesser, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So I saw that as an opportunity. I heard that. I heard them. And so I said, how about this? I was like, I'm gonna focus my business on developing the unarmed guard. The same way police officers are developed in the academy, that same level of excellence we have on our guards. So every process, every client we bring on, the onboarding, literally everything is obsessed with a quality guard, from what they wear, their personality, the team matching. And so even with the commercial buildings, you know, our clients are very brand sensitive. So they have to care about what things look like. Everybody cares about that, right? So you don't want the guard with the sagging pants, with the earbud in his ear, which I can't stand. It gives me like hives. But when they have that earphone in their ear, you know, how are you securing your community when you're distracted? Mm-hmm. So literally everything in our process leads to the guard showing up, perfect execution. They look good. They feel good. You feel safe. So I tell my guards, if I don't look at you and feel safe, that's a problem. So it could be anything. It could be your attitude. It could be how you speak. It could be what you look like, what you wear, you know, your shoes being dirty, everything. I should feel safe when I'm in a safety vehicle. So that's police officer. Even police officers, our unarmed guards, to give you a little bit of scope, outperform police officers. So it just shows you how attention to detail we are to the execution. If you stay in front of the safety, you shouldn't have to put your hands on anybody. So when I was a police officer, that was my model. So I developed rapport almost, you know, within 30 seconds. If I don't have rapport, I'm in trouble. So I'm developing that rapport and locking in, and I'm controlling the scene with relationships and respect. And so if I have to arrest someone, it's, you know, nice. I usually get the thank you. You know, they say, thank you for handling me so smoothly, like with respect. They'll go to jail because they know they're wrong. But the way you handle them is important. So I tell the unarmed guards that if you get in front of the execution, in 5 years, we've had one incident. One.
Wow.
And you tell me a security company that's doing that. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that it speaks to that the guards have not only caught on to the model of security being an emotion, but the culture of what we're building.
Can you break down your model of security as an emotion?
So we believe that not only is security an emotion, but it is it's not a business, but everybody deserves to be safe. They deserve it. So what it looks like is, we'll use the Super Bowl for an example, just because we're leaving Sunday and it's all over my brain. But we did the Super Bowl last year, and the client called, right? And as a lot of our clients are spoiled, so they call me. You know what? Let's not talk about Super Bowl. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, later. But last night it happened. Client calls at around 9 o'clock. There's an issue. They need a guard. So because security is an emotion, I ask the question, when do you need the guard? Immediately. Okay, you said immediately, which is right now. So we built the technology that allows us to mobilize very quickly. Because when our clients ask for something, we have to deliver. It's non-negotiable. Why? Because security is an emotion. So when I'm talking to them and they're texting me, I can see the anxiety. They're worried. They're afraid. So we have to deliver. Not delivering is not an option for our business model. And so what we did when I was a police officer for those 3 years, we built the teams, we built the processes. And so now our culture is so embedded that when a client asks for something, people are asking, I'll do it. Tell me where I need to be. And now it's just a competition on the rate, you know, cause they're like, I'll do it. And they set their own rates. I'll do it for this much. I'll do it for this much. I can get there in 30 minutes. I can get there in 15. So they start kind of navigating it. Then a guard gets it. He shows up on site and now the client feels safe. And we manage that all the way to the end. And we've never lost a client in 5 years. And our guard turnover is about 2%. So we're literally defying numbers in the security industry. And this year, we're going to start talking about how we've been able to do that. We haven't talked about it. They just see the result, mm-hmm. but they don't really know what the back end looks like and how we're doing it.
Can you talk about it yet?
So, yeah. So a little bit.
Okay.
The full story we'll give probably within the next couple of months. But we literally have built a technology that has caused us to manage the guard quality and the client communication. So people are like, so you're like Uber. I said, we're the opposite of Uber. So think about it. If Uber created the solution they have as an infrastructure solution for the taxi industry, total game changer, totally different business model. Why would you disrupt an industry that, say, New York and every metro Atlanta has come to depend on? Now, I ride Uber, so I'm a fan, right? So I use it. But security, because it's an emotion, you can't just throw technology to it. You can't just throw Uber and say, get in the car and ride, or get in the app and source. And then, no, people don't. It's like me hugging myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm afraid, so I'm literally going to hug. You don't do that. You reach out for somebody else, right? So people, when they feel unsafe, they're looking for that person to make them feel safe. That's Skyline. So we say, call us, we'll handle it. But what we've done now, as of this year, phase two of our app, is we've built the app. Now we're offering it to the industry. So we're lifting the industry. So it's as if Uber built the solution for the taxi industry.
So you're a real leader. You're leading the industry. You've changed the way that you not treat your employees, but your recruiting process and management.
So you're hearing it. So we're getting ready to talk about our technology, and people are always, are you afraid of duplication? I said, that's the most flattering thing, is when someone tries to duplicate what you're doing. But I challenge the person that may consider that. If you do that, do us the service of duplicating our culture. Because really, if you have a tech that we have a tech company, right? But that is not the solution. The solution is the culture. So you can have tech, but if you don't have tech without the guards, then you're really just another tool. We are a infrastructure solution that guarantees guard quality 100% of the time. And if they are not on point, then we have a problem. And so that's when we kick guards out. And we don't have an operations manager. The technology manages everything for us. And the guards are now used to that level of engagement. They pick their shifts. They set their rate. They manage everything. So we accommodate the guards and we accommodate the clients.
And so you brought up Uber. One of the things about Uber that kind of scares people is you don't know who you're getting into a car with. Right. So how do you recruit your guards?
Good question. Referrals only.
Okay.
So we have a referral based model for the guards and a referral based model for the clients. So people are like, it's not scalable. I said, I'm not trying to scale. I'm not. I think, we're trying to grow. We're not trying to scale. The tech will scale. I believe that security companies that service the local community like ours should stay underneath a certain threshold. Once you start, and you know, I won't get into naming, but once you start growing too big, you can see the quality start to diminish. They actually factor in loss. Loss for our culture is an insult because security is an emotion, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to make people feel safe all the time. And so our guards, it's interesting. Our guards have so much pride in who they refer. So like the other day, one of my guards who never refers. She referred someone. She called me. She was like, look, I just want you to know that I'm referring this person and I never refer. And I told her that she represents me. And if she doesn't perform well, that I'm going to, you know, they take a certain level of ownership. I love it. It's just natural. And they, I mean, these referrals are on point. I mean, they're really, really good. And I don't have to say a lot. I set the tone. I set the bar really, really, really high. They meet or exceed it. And if they don't, their referral will jump on them and then I'll jump on them. And then either they step up or they're gone.
They're on a short leash.
Oh, very short leash because our clients are used to perfect execution. And some people say that's not realistic. I say, oh, but it is. Like, so for me, you know, to know my background, like I'm an athlete, Clemson University, you know, and I just know perfect execution. That's all I know. So somebody raised the bar for me. And so if you're in our ecosystem, then the bar gets raised for you. And the guards only stay with me for a year. I kick them out.
Hmm.
So if I ask them, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? If they say anything about security, they're not a good fit.
Really? Why do you kick them out?
Because
seems counterproductive.
There is no way that you can make a living off of a security guard wage.
Hmm.
So I tell them when I interview them, you have to have a forward-thinking mindset. Right. So we're very attractive to young entrepreneurs.
Where did they go from security guard?
So we have photography companies. We have daycare centers. We have consultants. And so what my job is as their CEO is to take them from where they are to their purpose, not security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can do security, you can almost, like policing, if you can police a community, you can almost go in any, it's transferable skills. So as their CEO, my job is to build them, develop them. In a year, if you're still kind of freelancing, something, if you're freelancing to meet your bills for your company, that's one thing. If you're freelancing and you're just not really having any focus, those aren't the guards that we want.
So I've picked up on a couple words that have come up in some of your answers. Performance, mm-hmm. loss, focus. You said you're an athlete, but I think you're being kind of modest. You were on an Olympic team.
I was, 2004.
So yeah. Do you apply some of the knowledge you gained being on a team and working as a team, keeping the bar high, not losing, and you apply that to your business?
So yeah, you got it. So you're hearing all my little nuggets that I don't talk about. So, I did an article recently with a Clemson community magazine, and they asked me that question, you know, how much did Clemson attribute to your success? And I said, it's my secret. You know, my work ethic and I teach them that same work ethic. The same way the coaches raise the bar, I raise the bar for them. So I don't do well with excuses. And that has caused me to have a standard of excellence almost every single time. So it is literally my training regimen. And I said, shoot, if I did it and was successful, I don't think I'm, you know, my muscles may be a little stronger than the average person, but we could develop that. You know, I feel like everybody should have a shot. And a lot of these guards look at me in the interview with, they say goosebumps, and some of them get emotional because in an interview, has an employer ever asked you, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? If you ever had $1 million and all the time in the world, what would you be doing? And I just sit there and I wait for the answer. And they look at me like, you know, or some people know the answer. And some people are like, no one has ever asked me that. So I said, so for the next couple of months, I want you to think about that answer. And then when you get it, call me because I want to help you there. And being inside of this ecosystem should be forwarding, progressing, because when I was an athlete, nobody made it easy for me. So, and I am a byproduct of that kind of an unrealistic expectation. And every time my coaches set the bar, I exceeded it. So national records. And I was 7-time Hall of Famer. I was standing up on the stage at Clemson and I was just like, wow, this is my life. I had no idea. I was like, man, I wish I knew I was that good back then. but I just wasn't conscious. And so I said, you know what? I'm not anybody extra special. Somebody just was around me during those pieces where I was getting, you know, feeling like I was going to be unsuccessful, and they just pushed me back up. I didn't always like my coaches. So I use a lot of that in my business. And even when, like, I have to have a conversation next week, I tell them, I'm not going to make it easy on you. I'm sorry. And if this is too much for you, then, you know, I can accept that this is not an ecosystem for you. But then they look at me and they're like, I will raise the bar. I promise. And I say, that's your word. That's my word. And you can literally watch them develop. Like, it's more than just security. And I think that's what you're hearing. Like, it's more than just putting a guard there. There's a lot of work that we do before you even see that guard show up.
And it's more than just security and training people. You're really passionate about entrepreneurship.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And you went to the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. You were ambassador. Do you want to touch on that? That's
so
a big
awesome.
Deal. You're very modest, I'm finding out.
So I was grateful to be a part of two really, really, really good incubators. One is Launchpad 2X, Bernie Dixon, phenomenal 3-day core program. I was then referred to We Atlanta, which is a incubator hosted by the city of Atlanta. So they picked 16 women-led entrepreneurs, and that was where we bumped into the Super Bowl, got the email, mind you, referrals only, got the email and was super honored to be, to participate in that. And that was where the client called literally the second day and asked us to double our shifts. My stomach dropped and I knew we were in a stress test. I looked at my assistant and I was like, we're going to double our shift. She was like, let's do it. I'm like, I trained you guys too good. So I was like, okay, let's do it. You know, we never say no. So, we did that because of our technology, and the client was able to see the quality of our guards and was blown away. So not only did we build that relationship, but it caused the community to see us, where I was keeping us kind of hidden behind a rock a little bit so we can fine tune some things. It caused us to scale, almost 1,000%, between 800 and 1,000% in a year. I didn't have a life, literally in the middle of the scale, but we're still in testing. So because the community is pulling on us, we started looking at some, ways to grow successfully. I don't want to explode too fast. But we are literally, empowering, I don't like to use the word disrupting, but we're changing the way people engage security services. And we haven't even started talking about our technology yet. So we're very excited about that. I pitched at the graduation of We, and the Netherlands Consulate General offered the golden ticket to GES. And
that's the Global Entrepreneurship Summit
in The Hague. And oh my goodness, I went there and my mind just expanded. I came back with the understanding that we have to focus on our technology so that we can offer it to the world. And so we're looking at a 2-year global scale plan, which is crazy because we're still kind of nudging at the Atlanta market. We're in Savannah, Georgia, Miami, Houston. We got the Super Bowl coming up. We got a lot of big things coming. But we feel like this is the year, because now we're going to be able to talk about that infrastructure solution that not only is helping us, but that we're going to offer to the industry as well.
Well, I'm excited to hear about it. And if someone out here listening needs you for an upcoming event or to secure their office, yes, where can they find out more about you?
So go to our website. We're on all social media platforms. I keep my eye on all of them, so it won't get lost in the shuffle. But the easiest is our website, skylarsecurity.com. Every email I see, so we keep our hands on it. So there's also a request link on our website. I monitor that too, and we'll respond immediately.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. And that concludes another episode of Atlanta Cares Radio.